Thanks for joining me for another episode of All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast. I'm your host, William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com, your one-stop place for news and information about C.S. Lewis. With me today is Joe Rigney. He is Assistant Professor of Theology and Christian Worldview at Bethlehem College and Seminary. At the time of this interview, his book, Live Like a Narnian, was recently released, and he also recently had been one of the speakers at the 2013 Desiring God National Conference that focused on the life and work of C.S. Lewis. Welcome to All About Jack, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
Well, even though this is your first time on the show, I'm going to wait to ask you to tell more about yourself. So let's begin instead by having you give a 60 to 90 second summary, or as they might say in the business, a pitch to describe your book.
The book's called Live Like a Narnian, like you said, and the basic idea is that I believe that Lewis, and more importantly, I believe that God, Lewis wrote the book, God intends the book, the Chronicles of Narnia, to essentially shape and mold us into better Christians. And it does so not by simply being some interesting stories, but by the sort of themes, characters, theology that Lewis weaves into the stories. And so for my own part, I find that I've grown as a husband, a father, a friend, a teacher through my time spent there. And I think that's exactly what Lewis and what God intended for it to happen. You might say that I view the Chronicles of Narnia in the same way that I view things like devotional reading, even theological, heavy theological reading, or small group accountability, other things that we use in order to increase our holiness. That's how I've found that the Chronicles of Narnia have had an impact on me. And so the book is essentially an argument that that's what Lewis is doing, and then I walk through all seven books and sort of pick out some of the favorite things that I have, some of the most shaping things I think that are in there. I'm certainly not exhaustive. In the end of the book, I leave about 15 things I could have talked about and didn't. But I want to give readers a taste that there's more in these books than simply the surface level of the story. There's depth and layers and Narnian gold to be found if we'll only do some labor.
All right, you've partly answered my next question. Go ahead and pitch it, because it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek anyway. That is that, you know, your subtitle is Christian Discipleship in Lewis's Chronicles. And, you know, that basically could be even a shorter summary of the book. So a person may ask, antagonistically, are you trying to take the fun out of the stories by approaching them this way, or does this perspective actually help add to the richness of the stories?
Yeah, I think that's actually one of the things. That's actually really an important question. I'm not trying to take the fun out of the stories. I'm trying to put the fun back into discipleship. Or I should say Lewis is trying to put the fun back into discipleship. And I think one of the dangers of writing a book like this is that people will think, oh, I'm going to go, now when I go read the Narnian Chronicles, I'm just going to get the lesson. What's the moral of the story? What's the point? What's the abstract lesson that I can take from this character or so forth? And that's what I'm there for. And that's not what I think at all. Instead, I think that the first thing you ought to do in the stories is immerse yourself in them as stories. You ought to go live there. You ought to enjoy them. And you ought not think about really at all what you're supposed to be learning. Sort of, you might say, you submit yourself to the world of the story and let it kind of wash over you. Or the analogy that I use in the book and others have used and Lewis uses is learn to breathe Narnian air. So spend time in Narnia, breathe in the air. And what you'll find is that the book is doing things to you. This way of viewing the world, this way of viewing heroism and courage, this way of viewing submission and obedience, that has a shaping effect on you. And so what I want to do is take people who have immersed themselves in the stories as stories, and then I want to sort of comment, take a step out. You've experienced it. You've lived in it. Now take a step out, and let's think about what exactly happened. And so to do that, that's where I bring in some of Lewis's other writings, some of the thematic connections I think you can make between characters, and I try to draw, you see that? I just point at things and say, see what Lewis just did there? He's trying to do that to you. He thinks that that's a biblical thing, a godly thing, and he's trying to let it happen to you. So I would say the worst thing you could do would be to go to my book and just try to get the lessons. The best thing you could do would be to soak yourselves in the Narnian Chronicles for a while and then come back. And what you'll find, I hope, is all sorts of things in my book where you'll say, yes, that's exactly what's happened to me, and I wouldn't have put it that way, but that's it. And it will help identify things rather than being the lead-in.
Now, before going into details regarding your book, Live Like a Narnian, let's drop back and have you give some details about who you are and how you got into reading C.S. Lewis.
Sure. So presently I'm a professor of theology and Christian worldview at Bethlehem College and Seminary in Minneapolis. And I've been here for about 6 or 7 years as a professor, and before that I was a student here in our master's program. And I graduated from Texas A&M with a BA in communication. I'm originally from West Texas. I read the Chronicles of Narnia as a kid. I know my parents gave them to me. I don't remember my first reading of them. And then I read some of Lewis's other stuff in junior high and high school, Mere Christianity and things like that. But it wasn't until college, it was actually through the ministry of John Piper, that he would quote Lewis regularly, and so that kind of got me curious. And so I'd go track down the quotes that he mentioned and read those books. And then I'd also, kept reading the Narnian Chronicles periodically, enjoying them. I knew that there was a certain kind of Christian symbolism that was obvious, Aslan was Jesus and that sort of thing, but didn't give it much thought beyond that. Oh, there's a Aslan sacrifices himself for a sinner. Okay, I see that. That's really neat. But it was really actually when I was in seminary that I read a book, I guess right after seminary, read a book by Michael Ward called Planet Narnia. And that book just really opened up the Chronicles again for me in a whole new way. And Ward's thesis is obviously different from what I'm doing in the book, but it was very provocative and was all about the layers and intentionality and depths that Lewis put into these stories. And so that kind of reawakened the love for the Narnian books, not only as a scholar, as someone who's interested in the life of the mind, but also just reminded me how much I really enjoyed them. So I went back and read them through again in light of Ward's thesis and found them very fruitful. And so that led me to teach a class at our church called Live Like a Narnian, in which I sort of combined the things that Ward was talking about with my own reflections on reading the books, this time as an adult who's paying attention to what the book is trying to do to me, what the Chronicle is trying to do to my life and my soul and so forth. And so I taught that class, and so that's kind of what reawakened this love for the Chronicles beyond just a love for Lewis.
I read that you actually wrote this book in a short period of time. Did you, wake up one day and get the idea for the book, or was it something that was on the back burner, so to speak, for a while?
After I taught that class, I thought, man, there's some cool stuff here. Maybe it'd be fun to do a study guide or a book on this at some point, but it wasn't very high on the priority list. And then back in March, when I was invited to speak at the Desiring God conference on the subject, I was asked to speak on Live Like a Narnian. I thought, well, I've had this idea, and it is the 50th anniversary of Lewis's death. I guess I better strike while the iron's hot. And so that's what kind of brought it to the front burner, from the back burner. And so we just went from there. And so I did. I wrote it in a very short amount of time. My family, I have a wife and two kids, and they were out of town for a couple of weeks visiting family. And so I had a window. And so I would just come home from work and keep working, write the book. And I had students. I'm a college professor, so I had students come over twice a week for what I called Pizza in Narnia, where they would come over and I would read the chapters of the book to them. And the goal there was simply, I need some deadlines, otherwise I'll never get this done. And so if they come over, I've got to have something to say. And so it was an incentive to get the book done. And so I wrote it in a couple weeks, and then I've had some great help from some friends, David Mathis and a number of others, in trying to pull it together to get it published in time for the conference, which it was a month ago.
Right, and he actually made it possible for me to get a review copy, so I appreciate the opportunity to look into your book. I hadn't had a chance to finish it to the end, but I did enjoy what I read so far. And in fact, the next question here is regarding the introduction that I read. You actually warned the reader in your piece just before the introduction that it may be overly technical to some and that they shouldn't feel bad if they skip it. But yet, one of the things I want to point out is that you do clearly show how familiar you are with not just the Narnia stories, but a wide range of his other writings. Was this your main purpose in this introduction, or if not, what was?
Well, I think part of the purpose was that, you know, that I have two competing impulses. One is I love the stories of stories, and then I have this sort of academic bent. And so there's this desire to sort of show your work. And so the introduction is really an attempt to say, when I say that Lewis intended this stuff, I'm not just finding things here that are neat. I think that Lewis put them there, that I'm doing faithful exegesis, to use a term from biblical studies. I'm actually drawing out what I think Lewis has put in there, and I need to demonstrate that. And so the introduction is an attempt to say something about what Lewis thought about fairy tales, and he had a very high view of fairy tales. He didn't think they were just for children. His essay on stories is really wonderful in describing how he thinks about what these books can do, what fairy stories do in shaping us and molding us and helping us breathe this kind of air. And then I needed to say something about his view of discipleship, or what he would call education. And so for that, I went to Abolition of Man and talked about how education is about training us in the habits of heart and mind that are appropriate to the world. It's about creating, making us into certain kind of people who respond to the realness of reality, the objectivity of reality in a particular kind of way. And so when you take that view of fairy stories and then you take that view of education and you put them together, what you get, I think, is the Chronicles of Narnia. You get fairy stories which are designed to shape and mold us into a certain kind of person. So I wanted to defend that. I wanted to say, here's where I see it in some of Lewis's writings on fairy stories and on education. But it is a little bit technical, and some readers who are just interested in kind of seeing what the Chronicles are all about, I think could skip it, no problem, and just dive right in, and the proof, as they say, is in the pudding.
Exactly. Now, thinking about the book content more specifically, your chapters, I believe, are all just 10 pages or less. Is there a particular reason that you structured it that way?
Yeah, I wanted them to be brief. I had a very intentional desire for them to be, in some cases, very brief, because I didn't want them to drag on. I didn't want them to meander. I wanted to get to the point. And then, because part of it is I wanted people to read the chapters, and then I really want them to go back to the Chronicles. I don't, my book is not designed as an end in itself. It's designed to send people back there to let the books have their way. And so the sooner that someone can read my book and have something that they've seen before but never seen in that way light up, it might send them back into the stories a little bit more alive and alert. What's happening? What am I missing? And so yeah, that was really the goal. And you know, these days people have such short attention spans that if you try to string together a long, complicated argument, people get bored and wander away. And so there is a certain kind of additional effort it takes to say something meaningful in a short amount of space, and so I set that as kind of a challenge for myself.
Now, I noticed that you're in your dedication, which actually relates to some of your thoughts that you share in Chapter 12, your dedication is to your sons, Sam and Peter. It reads, "May you always be true sons of Arkenland, first in, last out, and laughing loudest." Could you elaborate on what you mean by these expressions?
Well, so the true sons of Arkenland is a reference to King Loon of Arkenland. King Loon is my favorite character in the stories, and which is odd because he shows up in one third of one book. You know, he's in the stories for just a hair's breadth, but he has a profound impact on me. And the reason is because I'm a father, and he's a father, and he's a father of two boys, and I'm a father of two boys. And the kind of father he is the kind of father that I want to be when I grow up. And so there's a number of things you could say, from the fact that he's a fighter, he's a warrior, he knows how to handle a sword. But even more than that, he's a gentleman. He knows how to bow to ladies. He knows that he's a man under authority. He says, you know, it's the law that makes a man king. I'm not God. I'm not the top. I'm under authority. And even beyond that, when it comes to his fathering, he loves his boys. When they show up, his eyes twinkle, his eyes light up, his face brightens, he embraces them, he hugs them, he's a very affectionate father. And so it's the kind of father that I want to be. And then when you get to the end of the book, and there's a section where Loon says what I think is my favorite line in all of the stories, and at least the one that has the most, packs the most punch for myself and what I hope to pass on to my boys. And the quote is that he says, "This is what it means to be a king, to be first in every desperate attack and last in every desperate retreat. And when there's hunger in the land, as must be now and then in bad years, to wear finer clothes and laugh louder at a scantier meal than any man in your land." And so you get this picture of what does it mean to be a king? Well, it means to be first in the attack and last in the retreat. And then when there's hunger, it means you laugh louder over the measly bread on your table than anybody else. So first in, last out, laughing loudest. That's what it means to be a king. And for me, I think that's what Lewis is doing there is that's what it, not just what it means to be royalty. That's what it means to be a man. That's what it means to be a husband and a father. That's what it means. That's what true masculinity looks like. And so whenever I put my boys to bed at night, one of the things I do, in addition to praying for them and so forth, is I say a blessing, part of which includes, may you grow up to be a true man of God. And then usually they will respond in some part of it. So sometimes I'll say first, and then my two-year-old will say in, last, and then he'll say out, laughing, and then he'll say loudest. Other times they just say the whole thing. But I want to inculcate in this idea that what manhood is, what it means to be a man of God, what it means to be a king of Narnia or king of Arkenland is to sacrifice yourself, to be the first in the battle, to want to run, where you are the battle's hottest and run that direction, to be the last out so that everybody else is safe, you're a protector, you're a guardian, that's what it means to be a man, and it means to do so with laughter in your bones, and to do so with a deep sense of the sovereignty of God over all things, which is, I think, where that laughter can come from, and a deep joy and glad-heartedness, so that you're not a shrill, angry fighter, but you're a happy warrior. And so that's a picture of what I think manhood is, and so it's a really beautiful thing.
Looking now earlier to the earlier part of your book, which is, again, Live Like a Narnian, the third chapter you deal with Edmund's character, but this is actually before his transformation, when he wasn't such a nice person. Is there really all that much to learn from this aspect of his character?
Yeah, I think one of the things that Edmund did, and this was something that I didn't really notice until I was paying more attention because I was seeing these other themes, and so this is one I think that I came to a little bit later, but I realized that most people think when they read the Narnian stories, say they read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is the one that they ought to read first, they read that and they think, wouldn't it be wonderful to get into Narnia? Wouldn't it be wonderful if it was real? Gosh, I wish I could get in there. And what Edmund's character does is he waves the flag and says, you might not actually want that. There's some dangers here that you ought to be aware of, because in Lewis's telling, Narnia only does to you, it only furthers the kind of person that you already are. So for Edmund, so we think, wouldn't it be wonderful to get in there? But what Edmund shows us, he's a beastly little boy. He's cruel to his sister. He makes fun of her. He provokes her. He's rude to his older siblings. We're told that he's beastly to any of the smaller kids at school. He's a very unpleasant character. He lies and all of this sort of thing. When he actually gets into Narnia, he doesn't meet, you know, a nice fawn who's going to become a friend, or he doesn't meet beavers. He meets the White Witch. You know, the author of the story, Lewis, guides him to meet a character who is going to tempt him and draw him into sin and draw him into gluttony and win his loyalty to the dark, to the evil side, to the White Witch's side. So here's a character who's beastly to begin with, and when he gets into Narnia, he just becomes more beastly. He becomes more evil. He starts on this downward spiral. And I think that there's a warning for that to us, which is the way I've come to say it is we're always sowing seeds of our future selves. You're sowing things right now into your life that will bear fruit later, and you might not like later based on what you're sowing now. And Lewis, this theme shows up in a lot of different places in Lewis's writings, many of which I don't even get into in my book, but I've noticed them again and again, that little things, little decisions, small decisions actually have great effect because they set us on trajectories. And Edmund's story is one that shows this is how bad it can go. By the end, he's trudging through the snow, plotting against the beavers who have shown him nothing but kindness. He's just stewing because it's cold, and he's just angry, and he's going to get rid of all the beavers, and he's going to show Peter what's what. And he's just plotting all this evil. He's gone from beastly to really bitter and evil, and then ends up captured by the White Witch with a knife at his throat, about to be sacrificed, tied to a tree. And it's at that moment where that's where his story could have ended. That could have been the end. But, of course, it's not a tragedy. It's a comedy. It's a deep comedy because Edmund's rescued, and then Aslan dies for him. And here we see how Aslan reaps what Edmund has sown. Edmund has sown bitterness, beastliness, and evil, and Aslan takes it onto himself and bears it away in his sacrifice. So I think that there really is a lot to learn in Edmund, and things that I don't even get into, but that your listeners can go track down, is what kind of man does he become after this? Not just in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but he shows up again in Prince Caspian, and he shows up again in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and he shows up again in The Horse and His Boy. Look at the kind of man he is after this transformation, and it's really remarkable. And there's a lot. I think there's a great lesson for us in tracing him throughout the stories.
Now, in your next chapter, you showcase, as your subtitle for that particular chapter says, the difference between giving advice and taking orders. It features another character that you enjoy from the Narnia stories. Who is it, and how can modeling his behavior help us today?
Yeah, so the character's Trumpkin, and I like Trumpkin a lot, not least because of all of his little witticisms, you know, bilges and beanstalks and
yeah.
And moonshine, and he's just fun. But the reason that I can't on him here is that he says something towards the end. Well, so I'll set up this way. One of the things that Lewis is doing a lot is trying to, he uses a literary device you might call a foil, which is where you take a character and you take take two characters, and one character is depicted in such a way that he sheds light on the other. So in this story, Nicabrick and Truffle Hunter are the foils. They really play off one another. They're very different characters. Nicabrick is a very sort of sour black dwarf, and Truffle Hunter is this faithful badger. And they're sort of opposite ends of the spectrum, and then Trumpkin's in the middle. Dispositionally, in terms of the kind of character he is, he's much more like Truffle Hunter. He's noble, he's kind, he's not going to kill anybody, he's not going to commit murder, that sort of thing. But he's also, unlike Truffle Hunter, he doesn't believe in Aslan. He has this, what you might call a defect. And so a big part of the books, I think, is of that book in particular, is showing what's going to happen. He's going to have to get off the fence at some point. And what's going to how is he going to get off the fence? And what will lead him? What part of his characters will be drawn out in order to get him either to fall fully onto Aslan's side, like Truffle Hunter, or to fall off on the other side and go full on Nicabrick, who's a sour black dwarf who's comfortable hanging out with hags and ogres and things like that. And the thing that I think does it is that Trumpkin says that at the end of the story, he doesn't believe in Aslan, and they're going to blow the horn, and they need to send messengers to these magical places in Narnia in order to be ready in case help comes. And so they're going to lose two warriors, which Trumpkin is upset about because he thinks this is all silly. And yet, when they begin arguing about it, Trumpkin finally says, "I'll go. Send me. I'll go and be one of those guys." And Caspian says, but you don't believe in the horn, Trumpkin." And then Trumpkin has this amazing statement. He says, "You're right, I don't. But what's that got to do with it? You're my king." And then this is what he says: "I know the difference between giving advice and taking orders. You've had my advice, now it's time for the orders." The beautiful thing about that is it shows the proper attitude of submission and obedience. Submission and obedience isn't quietism, it's not passivity, it's not just take it. It's give advice. If you think the plan is dumb, say that the plan is dumb. But never forget that there's a place for giving advice, and if you're not the one in charge, then there's also a place for taking orders, for doing what you're asked, or doing what you're told. And I think it's a great lesson in that for children with their parents, for parents with their employers at work, mm-hmm. For congregations and their pastors, and all different kinds, any kind of relationship where you have a headship and submission relationship. That principle is going to be massively important. Yes, give your advice, but when push comes to shove, you salute and say yes, sir, and off you go. And that's the way that God, that's what God calls us to. That's the kind of obedience that he wants to see.
Exactly. Yeah, that was a very good chapter. I enjoyed that. Now, obviously, we don't have time to discuss every chapter, but is there maybe, among the several other lessons, if you could pick one to share that's in another part of your book, Live Like a Narnian?
Yes, I think one of the ones that I particularly enjoy it's actually a theme that kind of runs throughout a lot of the book. And one of Lewis's targets, I think, over and over again in these stories is modern scientific, materialistic worldview, philosophy. And so he comes at this in a number of ways. So he's very skeptical of what he calls scientific conditioners. And I think it's an Abolition of Man where he refers to them. And it's the sort of people who want to remake their own image, and they're going to step outside and really tinker with us at a fundamental level. And there's a kind of tyranny that comes through that. They can do whatever they want to us because they're doing it to us for our own good or for the good of humanity. And so he's very concerned about this. But another part of this worldview that's so deadly in Lewis's mind is the reductionism of scientific explanation. That's a fancy way of saying anytime you say a human being is nothing but chemicals in motion, or love is just a chemical reaction in our brain. It's not actually, there's no actual thing called love. There is no soul. There is no heart. All of those things are just chemicals in motion. That's all they are. Because we can diagram it, or I can show you it under the microscope. Anytime you do that, Lewis thought you were robbing the world of something massively important. And so there's a great section in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader in which he says, Romandu, who is this retired star, is having a conversation with the kids, and Eustace says, wow, he's a retired star. You know, in my world, a star is just a ball of flaming gas. And Romandu replies, even in your world, my son, that's not what a star is, but only what it's made of. And so what Lewis is trying to say here is stars are not just big balls of flaming gas. If you say they're nothing but, this is the term for this that I use, is nothing buttery. I got it, I don't remember where, but I picked it up someplace along the line. Nothing buttery. A star is nothing but a ball of flaming gas. When you do that, you're not seeing what stars really are. That's just what a star is made of. Stars have much more potency. In the Bible, the stars in their courses fight against Sisera in the book of Judges. In the book of Job, we're told that the morning star sang for joy when God created the world. And in a star leads the wise men to the manger where they find Jesus, and then the stars come down from heaven and sing a choir. There's an angelic choir for the shepherds outside of Bethlehem. And so over and over again, the stars are doing things in the Bible. God had names. God calls them out by name in the book of Isaiah. And so stars are more than just a ball of flaming gas. And some people might say, well, those are just metaphors. And I think part of what Lewis is doing is, well, are they just metaphors? He's raising this question of why do we think metaphors are sort of a second-tier truth, a second-tier way of speaking. That's not the case at all. Metaphors are actually some of the most potent and real things that we have in reality. Is God is a father. Is that a metaphor? Sure, but it's true. God really is a father. It's not just a metaphor. It's a way of speaking truth. And so I think that little insight, which he just, it's a line or two in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, is massively important in re-enchanting the world and helping us to see the glory and the wonder of what's really there.
Exactly. Yeah, I actually had Dr. Michael Ward on as a guest. We actually did a series in addition to a standalone interview with the Narnia Code, and that is one of the many things that he points out as well. It's a very good thing to, you know, be aware of and to reflect on and to see the different influences and, you know, how to kind of, you know, counter against that. Well, Joe, I've noticed that you're actually on Twitter. Is there any other place online where people can find and read material that you've written? And then also, what's the best way for people to buy your book, Live Like a Narnian?
Like you said, I'm on Twitter, Joe_Rigney on Twitter. I do blog occasionally at desiringgod.org. And so if you were to go there, you could find a handful of blog posts on various things, including some on Lewis and Jonathan Edwards and various other subjects there, so you can go track down some articles and blogs I've written there. And then if you find my faculty page at BethlehemCollegeAndSeminary.org, there are a number of sort of audio resources, some chapel messages that I've given, a seminar given on honoring the giver by enjoying the gifts. How do we honor God in our enjoyment of all the good gifts? There's some very heavy Lewis elements in that seminar as well, and that's being worked into a book down the road. So both of those places would be places you could find me online. In terms of buying the book, the best way is at Amazon. So you can buy the hard copy there, or it's available for Kindle. It's also available for Nook if you're a Barnes & Noble ebook reader. And so those would be the best places to get it.
And we'll also provide links in the show notes. So if you go to EssentialCSLewis.com for the article there, and search for Joe Rigney, that's R-I-G-N-E-Y, you can find the show notes, as well as just do a direct search through whatever search engine you might use. Well, as we wrap up, Joe, would you summarize why an individual should, again, consider getting your book?
You know, it's always funny to write a book that requires people to have read seven other books first, and you say that in the book. You know, it's a great way to sell copies. I think that the best thing for someone to do, if they've never read the Narnian Chronicles, would be to pick those up and read them. And I suppose it could be a thing where you would pick up the Narnian Chronicles and start with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and have my book next to it and read the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and then read the three chapters on that book and then kind of progress your way through there, kind of highlighting things as you go. But the real person who's going to benefit the most is going to be someone who's lived in Narnia for a long time, which I imagine many of your listeners have. And so for that kind of person, I'd say pick up the book and maybe refresh yourself a little bit with the Chronicles and then go in there and just see if what I say about the books rings true. See if it resonates with your experience and the way that the Chronicles have shaped you. And what I think you'll find is it's done things to you that far surpass what you thought. There's layers and depths to its influence on you that you might not have even been aware of. And I want to draw those out, highlight those a little bit, so that and maybe point out some more that you ought to go and have them shape you in that way, so that you can give glory to God and express gratitude to Him for the wisdom of C.S. Lewis.
Well, before ending with my guest today, let me remind you again to stop by EssentialCSLewis.com for other interviews I've done with a variety of guests. I mentioned just a little bit ago about Dr. Michael Ward. I did a series with him as well as a standalone. And other books, this is being recorded in 2013. Quite a number of books have been released. I've had the opportunity to speak with several authors regarding that. EssentialCSLewis.com also has other resources on Lewis, including a daily quote and fact. Well, Joe, I look forward to talking with you again maybe in the future. Thanks for being my guest today.
Thank you very much.